From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Washington Post says it's obtained a transcript of the first call between President Trump and Mexican President Peña Nieto. In it, Trump tells the Mexican president to stop rejecting paying for the border wall. Quote, "You cannot say that to the press." Meanwhile, there's President Trump's proposed plan to cut in half the number of legal immigrants to the U.S. to favor highly skilled workers and English speakers. Yesterday, CNN's Jim Acosta and White House senior advisor Stephen Miller tussled over that. Acosta, citing the poem on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor," said there's nothing in there about being a computer programmer or speaking English.
This whole notion of, well, they could learn, you know, they have to learn English before they get to the United States. Are we just going to bring in people from Great Britain and Australia?
Jim, I have to honestly say, I am shocked at your statement that you think that only people from Great Britain and Australia would know English. It reveals your cosmopolitan bias to a shocking degree.
Alan Gomez is immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, the president says with his plan, U.S. businesses will be forced to raise wages to lure Americans who historically haven't taken jobs that legal immigrants do. Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, says this would devastate businesses in his state. What's the research?
The research indicates very clearly that there are jobs that Americans just are not willing to do anymore. Obviously, we're talking about agricultural jobs, a lot of those lower-skilled, lower-paying jobs, and that's why they need more of these lower-skilled workers to keep the American economic engine going.
Yeah.
President Trump even addressed this just recently. We heard him talk a lot about the need for high-skilled labor coming into the country during that press conference yesterday. But a couple of weeks ago, his Department of Homeland Security approved 15,000 new H-2B visas. Those are visas that are designed for people who come in to do low-skilled work. And so, you know, on the one hand, he's saying we need these short-term workers. We need these lower-skilled laborers to come into the country to sustain some of our companies. But on the other, he comes out and issues this big proposal to upend our immigration system to curtail their ability to come into the country.
Well, let me ask you about that, because there is a difference between someone coming in on a visa to do, let's say, 3 months in the summer at a resort, and someone coming in and applying, you know, to be an immigrant, to come here and stay, a legal immigrant. What are the economic implications if it's the second category? In other words, can you make do with seasonal workers on a visa basis?
Right. And that's something that the president himself addressed during his first address to Congress. He quoted a National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine study. This was a landmark study that came out last year that found that first-generation immigrants cost U.S. taxpayers $57.4 billion a year. In other words, they come in, they're not doing the most high-wage work, their salaries aren't that much, and so they end up being a net drain on the U.S. But what he left out, and what was also included in that study, was that by the time we get to the second generation of those immigrants, they end up being a net increase of $30 billion. And by the third generation, they end up being a net positive of $223 billion. So through education, through these, the longer that they stay here, the more that their families end up contributing to the U.S. economy.
I think his own family came from Germany. So,
exactly.
You know, so this is a generational thing. And that was part of the plan that was suggested yesterday, that these immigrants would not have as much access to benefits.
Right. Right now, there are laws for any immigrants. They cannot be deemed a public charge. They cannot become a ward of the state. They cannot be dependent on the government for their income. But there are all sorts of different loopholes. So, for example, you cannot be an immigrant, enter the country, and immediately start getting cash assistance. You can't get income assistance, but you are allowed to get Medicaid, food stamps, school lunches, housing benefits, child care benefits. You can attend public schools. And what the president is proposing is to shut most of that off. I mean, there are a couple of things like education that he probably couldn't, because there are Supreme Court rulings on that. But they do have the power, if they pass this through Congress, to really cut off a lot of those other income streams and those other welfare streams that a lot of the immigrants are receiving when they first get to the country.
How will this overall impact diversity in immigration policies? And by the way, this has to be voted on by Congress. Right now, as we said, there's a lot of pushback. But what countries would be coming and what wouldn't in general? Can you guesstimate that?
Well, the easiest losers here would be people who enter the country through the diversity visa program. Those are 50,000 visas a year that are granted to people from countries that are underrepresented in the United States, and that mostly goes to people from Africa, Eastern Europe, and Asia. But more broadly, when you look at the idea of upending the immigration system to be more economic-based and moving away from a family-based system, it means that people who are coming here are going to have those college degrees, are going to need English proficiency, and that obviously narrows the pool of countries where people can come from.
Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, a second firefighter has died in Montana in what's being described as Montana's worst fire season in years. There have been so many fires this season that the money allocated in the state to fight them is running out, and the state is dealing with a budget shortfall after forecasted revenues came in lower than expected. Joining us now is John Tubbs, who's director of the Montana State Department of Natural Resources and Conservation. Welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, we just want to offer our condolences. So sorry to hear about the loss of now two firefighters in Montana.
Yeah, it was another tragedy in Montana. It just reminds us all of the risks that the young men and women and the older men and women who are fighting fires in Montana as well as across our nation are taking every day. So let's keep them in mind.
Well, tell us about the conditions that you're experiencing there right now.
It has really dried out in the state of Montana to an extreme conditions. We have extreme drought in northeastern Montana, rapidly drying conditions statewide, and in particular in northwest Montana. And we've had fire activity in July that would typically be seen in August.
Why is this year such a bad year for wildfires there?
Well, initially, Predictive Services had it as a normal year, but the moisture just stopped coming and extremely high temperatures plus added winds.
And as we mentioned earlier, dealing with the cost to fight these fires is really becoming a problem. How bad is it right now from a financial point of view?
Well, you know, when we're fighting fires, what we really care about is keeping Montanans safe. We in Montana have set up a fire reserve. Unlike at the federal level, we did come into this fire season with over $30 million prepaid for fighting fire. We are using that at about $1 million to $1.5 million a day. Hmm. And this fall, we'll wrap our heads around just exactly how much it costs.
Well, what if you run out of that money? What happens then?
Well, really, we don't run out. So our ability to fight fire will not be constrained by cash. We have reached out in one instance to FEMA and requested a fire management assistance grant. It was a little bumpy, but we did receive that grant for the Lodgepole fire. We also cost share with our federal partners. But it is going to be an expensive season.
We just had a lengthy conversation with an author who's written a book called Land on Fire, all about the wildfires in the West. And he points out that because of climate change, this is going to be happening more. The season's going to be longer. It's drier. Are you expecting that what you're facing this year is going to be something you're now going to face every year or almost every year?
Well, climate change is affecting our resource management. It certainly is a driver in fire. We have consistently warmer summers, longer seasons. You know, you just have to talk to on-the-ground firefighters. They're seeing behavior that is just not consistent with how we fought fire when I did in the 1980s. You know what? One of the things that we really think that needs to happen is Congress and the fire funding for our federal agencies. You know, we need an approach much like any natural disasters where these large fires are treated as national emergencies. And to date, that's not how fire is funded at the national level.
Well, you mentioned FEMA earlier. How much help do you get from the federal government on something like this? And how much do you have to just rely on what the state can provide?
Well, there's a combination of questions there. So the first is that FEMA does provide a granting program for states to assist their efforts in fire suppression. We have applied for that in one case. It was the nation's number one priority fire. It burned upwards of 300,000 acres which is hard to get your head around how big that is. It's half of Rhode Island. It was in a rural landscape, but those people really were facing a terrible situation. We did get that grant. We are looking at potential future grants. When we ask for that, we really do need the assistance.
And what about from the state? I know that you were on a call yesterday with the governor, Steve Bullock, in Montana. Are you getting everything you need from the state?
Absolutely. You know, what he told me was, John, you keep fighting fire, protect our lives and property out there. We'll settle down in September or October. Let's hope it's September when the season comes to a close. And we can roll up the numbers at that point in time. But our number one priority is protecting people and property.
That's John Tubbs, who is director of the Montana State Department of Natural Resources and Conservation. John, thank you for joining us, and good luck with the fires.
Thank you, Jeremy. Keep those firefighters in your mind.
We will. It's hard to believe, but it's been less than a week since President Trump replaced Chief of Staff Reince Priebus with General John Kelly. We're going to hear from two former chiefs of staff on the show today, Andy Card, who served President George W. Bush, and Leon Panetta, who was head of the CIA and Secretary of Defense under President Obama and Chief of Staff under President Clinton. He's currently chairman of the Panetta Institute for Public Policy in California. Secretary Panetta, welcome back. And do you think that John Kelly is someone who's going to make a difference in the Trump White House?
Well, John Kelly is somebody that I know well because he served as my military aide when I was Secretary of Defense. And he is, first and foremost, a Marine who's very dedicated to public service very, very committed to whoever is commander in chief, but more importantly, is somebody who wants to accomplish the mission. I think he's got the right qualities necessary to be a great chief of staff. I think the fundamental question is whether or not President Trump will support the changes that he has to make if he's going to improve White House operations.
Can he be an effective chief of staff? Can anyone be an effective chief of staff if there are still people underneath him who have direct access to the president? I'm thinking of people like Ivanka Trump or Jared Kushner.
Well, there are some very important steps that a chief of staff needs to take. One is that they're can really only be one chief of staff. If there are a number of people, other assistants who can go directly to the president or go around the chief of staff, that's a prescription for chaos. So I think one of the steps is to make clear that there is one chief of staff and that other staff have to report to him. Doesn't mean that they can't present their views to the president, but it has to follow a process. I mean, those are some key steps that need to be taken. And frankly, that's what John Kelly is about. This is a Marine who believes in discipline, who believes in a strong chain of command, who believes in a process for policy development. And, I think that's what he's going to want to put in place. And frankly, that's what the White House needs.
Now, President Clinton didn't tweet when he was in office. There wasn't Twitter at that point. But was there anything like that you ever had to go in and say, Mr. President, I really think it would be best if you didn't do this thing that you do? The way that some people are saying John Kelly should go to the president and say, stop tweeting.
Well, there's no question that what this White House has lacked is an adult in the Oval Office who could look at the president in the eye and tell him when he's making a mistake, telling him when he is doing something wrong. And that is part of the role of being a good chief of staff, is the ability to look at the president and tell him when he's wrong. Most staff are intimidated by the president, don't want to offend him, usually are yes people who say that whatever he does is okay. But frankly, it's not going to work unless you have somebody who's able to be very honest and direct with the President of the United States. That's needed. President Clinton and I developed that relationship. It's not to say presidents always like being told when they're wrong, but they also, I think, respect the fact that they have to know when they're about to make a mistake that will cost their presidency.
Congress just passed a bill, and the president has signed it, which includes new sanctions aimed at punishing Russia for its interference in last year's election. Do you think that this is an appropriate response, or would you go further?
Well, I think the Congress took the right step. You know, it would have been better if the president had done it on his own. But by virtue of the president now signing the bill, I think the United States has sent a very strong message to Russia that we are not going to tolerate the kind of behavior that they engaged in during the last election.
This also included sanctions on North Korea, which, as you know, tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile just recently. Where do you think we're headed with North Korea at this point? Senator Lindsey Graham said on Tuesday that a military strike is inevitable if North Korea continues.
Well, there's no question that North Korea, by virtue of what they've done in improving their ICBMs and the work they're doing on miniaturizing a nuclear weapon, that they represent a real threat to our national security. So we have to take strong military steps. I think that is important. But at the same time, you also have to take some strong diplomatic steps. These sanctions are important, but there also has to be outreach to determine whether or not there is any possibility of being able to negotiate with the North Koreans and try to resolve the situation peacefully. Whether or not that can happen, obviously, is a question that concerns everybody right now. But the fact is that there's a reason we haven't taken military action. It's because of the consequences, which are unacceptable both to South Korea and to the world. We could be in a nuclear war. Nobody wants that to happen. So I think we do have to operate carefully, but we do have to operate with strength.
But in that instance, could North Korea test a missile every week and we still wouldn't respond in any other way than sanctions?
Well, I think that is something that we can take action on, which is to make clear that we are not going to allow them to continue to test their missile capabilities. They're violating international law. We have taken steps to try to interfere with their ability to fire these missiles, some of which have been successful, some not. But I do think we have to make clear to the North Koreans that we are not just going to simply stand by and allow him to test these missiles. If they start firing intercontinental ballistic missiles, I think we ought to make clear that we have the capability to be able to take those missiles down.
Last week, President Trump announced a ban on transgender people serving in the military. You were very critical of that decision. It sounds like the military is not going to act on that until they get an official word from the White House, not just a tweet about it. But do you think that's really going to happen? Is there going to be a ban on transgender people serving in the military, or is this just talk and tweets?
Well, I think hopefully one of the things that John Kelly can do is to bring a policy process back in place that allows for policy decisions to be made in an orderly way, allows the Pentagon and military leaders to participate in the decision-making process. That's the way it's supposed to work through the National Security Council. And for the president to suddenly just tweet out a major change in policy, I think the Pentagon took the right step in saying, a tweet is not a directive. That has to be developed by the president in an orderly way. And my hope is that John Kelly can get his arms around this and try to put in place a policy development process that can better serve the president and better serve the country.
So you think it's possible that the ban won't happen?
Well, I think it's possible that, appropriate revisions can be made that can at the same time allow those who are serving and want to serve their country the opportunity to be able to do that. We've had to make some tough decisions. We did it when I was secretary in getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I wanted women to be able to serve in combat. It was not easy, but you can get past some of the concerns. And I think the same thing is true here. I think we are a stronger country when we allow everyone the opportunity to be able to serve their country.
One more question, Secretary Panetta. Do you think that President Trump and Congress are going to be able to move on to some of the other big items on their agenda this year, like tax reform, and pass it, given that they were unable to repeal the Affordable Care Act, even though Republicans control both houses of Congress?
It is not going to happen if they follow the same process they did with regards to health care. The reality is that President Trump is not going to get anything done simply by trying to push it through in a partisan basis, just relying on Republicans. First of all, Republicans are divided themselves. That was reflected in the health care debate. I think the better approach, frankly, if he wants to get anything done, is to develop, first of all, develop policy proposals that you can make to the Congress, and then work with both Republicans and Democratic leaders in developing that legislation. If he does that, he has a much better chance of being able to accomplish some of these goals, whether it's health care, whether it's tax reform, whether it's funding for infrastructure, whether it's the budget. He simply has to change the way he's approaching these issues on Capitol Hill if he's going to have any chance of being able to develop a record.
Do you have any hope that he'll do that?
My hope is that this new Marine in the White House might be able to to bring some of that common sense, hopefully, to the White House and to the president.
That's Leon Panetta, who was director of the CIA and defense secretary under President Obama, chief of staff to President Clinton, and is currently chairman of the Panetta Institute for Public Policy. Secretary Panetta, thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Jeremy.
And we're also speaking with Andy Card today. He was chief of staff to President George W. Bush. If you miss it on the radio, you can listen at hereandnow.org. Typically, when a city is awarded the Olympics, there's a big ceremony, lots of celebration. But this week, when it became clear that Paris will host the 2024 Summer Games and Los Angeles the Games in 2028, there wasn't much fanfare. Why not? Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And were these cities, the two cities, the only ones left that wanted the games in 2024 and 2028? I mean, what do you make of this?
Yeah, Boston, Budapest, Hamburg, Rome, they all dropped out. Mm-hmm. So you have this situation, three entities, the IOC, Paris, and L.A. Paris is fine with getting them in 2024. Essentially, they win for the bid for the next game. Los Angeles likes the deal because with the larger lead time, the Olympics decided to give them some extra money up front, like $180 million, maybe even more. And immediately, Mayor Eric Garcetti can turn to his people and say, this money is being used for parks, for youth sports activity. There's a tangible benefit to that. The IOC, here's an analogy. Have you ever been to a charity auction, Jeremy?
Yeah.
And they might, if it's something tangible that there's only one of, tickets to a show, you can't do this. But let's say it's an experience, you know, swim with the dolphins, and you have two bidders, $4,000, $5,000. You can try to get the second bidder to, you know, one up the guy who bid $5,000, or you can say, and I have seen brilliant auctioneers do this, hey, what do we say? We sell two tickets,
right,
or two experiences to swim with the dolphins, and then kind of everyone wins, but especially the house.
We've done that, actually, in a public radio auction, given away two at twice the price. Right. But if you look back at some of the places that have hosted the Olympics in the past, and let's just talk about Rio de Janeiro. It cost $13 billion to put those Olympics on. Brazil is in its deepest recession since the 1930s. Is the Olympic Committee going to find it increasingly harder to find cities that are willing to host the Olympics?
I think they had been, and the decision, the unusual decision to give away two in one fell swoop reflects this reality. And I also think it reflects Brazil had a lot of problems, very much including the ill will of the Olympic Committee or not caring what Brazil was going through. But they went from economic boon to deep recession in between the periods where they were awarded the Olympics and they actually happened. I mean, we just saw yesterday, you know, the president of Brazil narrowly avoiding becoming the third leader in a row to be charged with corruption. Right. They had their problems. The Olympic Committee did not care as long as they got their money. Then Thomas Bach, who's the new president of the IOC, said different things. I was at the Buenos Aires meeting when they decided to award Tokyo the Games. It seemed more talk then. But I think what this shows is that they really are aware that they can't just give these white elephants to countries and have countries say, thank you, sir, may I have another, you know, and especially with the Winter Games, they were out of democracies, for instance, who were willing to do this. So if the Olympics only became something for tin pot dictators to burnish their credentials, I think a lot in the Olympic movement found fault with that.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Two replica Christopher Columbus ships are sailing across the Great Lakes this summer. The vessels offer visitors a chance to learn about the famous explorer's voyages, but some say the ships only tell half the story. Payne Horning from WRVO in upstate New York reports.
Aboard the Pinta replica in Oswego, New York Harbor, tour guide Colin Foster lectures a group of students about Columbus and his famous voyages.
It was 33 days to cross the Atlantic Ocean. Everybody has to remember that, okay? How many days did it take to cross? 33 days. We have to remember that.
The Pinta replica was built to complement the popular Niña ship, which set sail in 1992 to commemorate the 500th anniversary of Columbus's first voyage across the Atlantic. Captain Morgan Singer says both vessels were always intended to be a tool to educate people.
They can touch, they can feel, and they can imagine what it was like for their forefathers, be it on these ships or the Mayflower or whatever.
Teaching is the motivation for many of the crew's 14 members, all of whom are volunteers. Jeff Hicks says their mission is to inform people about Columbus and the explorers who followed.
He did discover it for the old world. They know nothing of this part of the world. And again, we celebrate the age of discovery because without that, we as Americans today and in this part of the world would not be here.
But not all are as eager to celebrate that legacy. That was clear in Oswego, a Lake Ontario port where the ships docked recently. The replicas were surrounded by protesters in canoes, and on the pier, other protesters carried signs. Gahiwinessa, a Native American and member of the Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, noted that the age of exploration brought with it mass murder, slavery, and diseases for the original people of the Americas.
You know, to make a replica of the ships that did that to our own people, and, you know, to even let it sail again into these waters isn't right. It's a huge slap into the face.
Professor Philip Arnold, who teaches Native American and Indigenous Studies at Syracuse University, says those issues still resonate today and should not be ignored.
It's hard to get over that kind of trauma. It's as if we were to ask Jews to get over the Holocaust or something, you know, akin to that. I think, you know, a discussion would be good for everyone.
An exchange of ideas did take place in Oswego. The Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation were able to open an informational booth at the entranceway to the ships. And local summer school principal Bob Nelson says he made sure to fill in the gaps for the students he brought.
Of course, everybody's taught 1492 Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Well, there was a little bit more to it than that. So that's what we try to show them, just to get them thinking a little bit.
Jake Edwards, a member of the Central New York Onondaga Nation, says these replica ships present an opportunity to have that conversation as they move through the Great Lakes.
So we pass the message on to all of our brother nations across the country that these ships may come in contact with again, and to stand up and explain to them what had happened to their people, to our brothers, what had happened because of this ship landing and bringing its tactics of survival here on our lands.
The replica ships will continue along the Great Lakes this summer with stops in Ohio and Michigan and then onto the Mississippi River. For Here and Now, I'm Payne Horning in Oswego, New York.
And Payne's story comes to us from Here and Now contributor Great Lakes Today.
Well, we thought we'd take a moment to pay a tribute to one of the great editors of the literary world. Judith Jones died at her home in Walden, Vermont, Wednesday at 93. Just a couple of her achievements. She was responsible for the publication of the English version of The Diary of Anne Frank. As an editor at Alfred A. Knopf, she plucked an 800-page manuscript for a French cookbook from a pile and championed it through publication, thus introducing Mastering the Art of French Cooking and Julia Child to the world. Judith Jones also nurtured the careers of other cooking luminaries, James Beard, Lydia Bastianich, and Mauder Joffrey. She worked with authors from the literary firmament, John Updike, Anne Tyler, and John Hersey. In 2009, Judith Jones published The Pleasures of Cooking for One, about cooking for herself after the death of her husband, Evan. We spoke to her about that book in November of that year. It was clear the many cookbook authors she worked with, close friends, made their way into her book as well.
I feel very strongly that each cookbook should have a voice. So I try to help somebody get that voice. And as a result, over the years, I've accumulated quite a large family of writers. And they're always there with me when I'm doing an Indian dish, for instance. I hear Mauder's voice saying, you have to toast that paste. What does it mean to toast a paste? So you learn constantly.
Well, when you talk about helping the writers that you worked with have a voice, do we understand that it was you who advised Julia Child to use down-to-earth words like plop to explain French cuisine?
She did instinctively. I cannot take credit for that. It was just in her. But I did encourage her to use much more of that individual voice, and I think it certainly worked.
Yes, it did. And just staying with Julia Child for a second, there was a bit of a controversy about Julie Powell. This was the young New York City woman who tried to make Julia Child's recipes in 365 days. Her book, of course, was the basis for the film Julie and Julia, but it started with a blog.
I called Julia out in California, and she said, well, we better both look at that blog. And so we did, and Julia said, I don't feel she's very serious because of the kind of language she uses. It was just using easy four-letter words that don't go with food. And it was as simple as that. She didn't hate her or try to stop her or anything, but she just felt that she wasn't doing it because she wanted to learn cooking or express joy and triumphs and what things tasted like, and so she wrote her off as not very serious. Had she lived to see what happened, it's quite amazing because the movie has so stimulated young people into thinking, gosh, I want to learn to cook. It looks like fun. And they go out and buy Mastering. So who knows? It wasn't a big issue. She just felt not connected.
Well, because of the four-letter words, and we should rush to say the four-letter words Julie Powell was using were not plop.
No, they weren't.
Julia Child's words. I want to ask you, while we're talking about these many people you've worked with as a real hands-on editor, you said of John Updike that he was very daring in print, but he wasn't daring in his food and what he ate?
Well, no, he was pretty much a Pennsylvania meat and potatoes boy. I once talked to him about what I call food and language and how you can delineate character through food prejudices, through the joy of making food for others. And I was contrasting him with another writer I work with, Anne Tyler, who wrote that wonderful Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, I don't think that food is a very serious factor. I mean, he sort of just sloughed it off. But when I went back and looked in the second Rabbit book, Rabbit Redux, when Rabbit leaves home and takes off with this young flower girl, and suddenly for the first time he's eating in a whole different way. And there's a paragraph there describing the sole that she cooks and the white wine he has for the first time. And it reminded me of a Julia Child soigné meal that she had the first time she ever went to France. And indeed, it was a pivotal moment in Rabbit's character. He was changed by this. So even though a writer thinks he's not using food, watch it. It's a very powerful metaphor for many things in our behavior.
I will now read, food passages in books in a different way.
Look for it. And it's being used more and more as food is part of our language today. That's very much my point. When I was growing up, we never discussed it at the table. You were never allowed to say yum, yum sounds. We were constantly opening the windows to get rid of the cooking smells.
That's right. Nothing like boiled cabbage or broccoli sprouts or whatever they were.
That's right.
Judith Jones, thanks so much.
Well, thank you. It's been fun talking to you.
We spoke with a delightful and legendary editor, Judith Jones, in November 2009, and I wish I'd been able to talk to her again about my saying broccoli sprouts instead of Brussels sprouts. Oh, what a delight. Judith Jones died on Wednesday at the age of 93. It's Here and Now. President Trump inherited America's longest war, and he's reportedly increasingly frustrated by how it's being fought. NBC News reports that during a contentious mid-July meeting, the president told his national security team the U.S. is losing in Afghanistan, and he proposed removing the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson. News of that meeting came last night, a day when two U.S. troops were killed when a suicide bomber attacked their NATO convoy near Kandahar, the Taliban quickly claiming responsibility. Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. Phil, what does this reporting about this alleged meeting say to you about the debate over Afghanistan strategy?
Well, from what we understand from that story and from our correspondent Tom Bowman at the Pentagon, people in the White House, especially the president, as you described, are very frustrated with what they perceive to be the limited options being presented to them by the top military commanders, including Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and the National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. Trump, as you said, inherited this conflict, which generals beforehand have said basically is in stalemate. And in the president's words, according to that report, he believes that, in fact, the United States is losing. And at the same time, he's not getting anything for his own purposes that makes it seem as though any policy that he puts into place could do anything more but just continue the policies of his predecessors. And by all appearances, he's very frustrated by that.
By the way, what is the policy in Afghanistan?
Since the Obama administration, the United States has tried to consolidate as much as possible of the work done by the last phase of the war in Afghanistan, where there were about 100,000 troops across the country clearing and holding and then building areas of Afghanistan that had been long under the control of these insurgent Taliban forces. But since that peak of troops, today there are, by comparison, only about 8,500 American forces across the country, and the Afghan National Security forces, which were stood up by the United States and its international allies at great cost, have not been able to protect the areas of the country from the insurgent Taliban. Mm-hmm. And today, the Taliban is on the march in a lot of places, especially in the south. And so the United States has been planning to send yet more troops, possibly about 4,000 more troops, to help in key places and also potentially do some direct fighting of their own. That's the strategy that Trump, we understand, has been presented, although he hasn't actually authorized it yet. And this meeting that took place last month was for him to kind of review the bidding in terms of what those troops might do and what his options might be. And I don't know that anyone expects, inside or outside the White House, that the United States can do much more than just keep this at a low boil, because the nature of the war there and the nature of the limits of the Afghan government mean there aren't many more things that Washington will be able to do.
Well, when President Trump said we're losing the war, Secretary of Defense James Mattis said that's because the U.S. doesn't have the right strategy, but he told Congress he'd have a new strategy by mid-July. That deadline passed. Today, Senator John McCain released a statement defending General Nicholson, the commander in Afghanistan, but also saying he, McCain, would offer his own strategy if the president and Pentagon can't come up with one. You're saying that, you know, there's kind of this realization that maybe you just keep it, as you said, as a low boil. But we're also hearing there is a debate within the administration, you know, send more troops, while advisor Steve Bannon arguing against further involvement.
That's right. I think from that school of thought, this would just be more of the same, and you would amount to a perpetual American military presence in Afghanistan, which, in the view of hawks like John McCain, is actually a good strategy, because what you want to do in this school of thought is take away these artificial timelines that he argues the past administrations have placed in Afghanistan by saying, we'll have all the troops out by a certain date, that just enables the insurgent forces there to wait you out, and instead say, the United States will treat Afghanistan the way it has treated military presences in Asia and Europe after World War II, where in a lot of cases, American troops never left. And the strategic benefit for the McCains of the world is to make a commitment and say, we will never again let terrorists like al-Qaeda use this country as a base from which to launch an attack on the U.S. And if that means that American troops are there for 50 more years in this school of thought again, so be it. Obama was definitely much more of a dove after the peak of the American troop presence there. And he and his administration officials concluded there wasn't much more that the United States could do, because Afghanistan will just never get to the point where you have this Switzerland in Asia Minor that George W. Bush's administration once envisioned, just because of the way the military is, because of the way the government is. And so Afghan good enough was their watchword, which was the phase that Trump inherited. That was before these military gains the Taliban have made against the government, and before it kind of put the United States in a position where the Pentagon was supporting sending more forces just to kind of keep body and soul together.
Phil Ewing, I have to ask you, in about the minute we have, the day before this mid-July meeting we've been talking about, President Trump also sat down with service members that had spent time on the ground in Afghanistan, kind of said they know more than their leaders. He compared them to waiters who know the ins and outs of restaurants. Does he run the risk of insulting his generals too much? And you only have a few seconds there. Sorry.
Well, I think there is a lot of tension there, as you heard from McCain today. And the more tension he has with the Pentagon, the more difficult it is for them and the White House to come to an agreement about what to do in Afghanistan. Yeah.
Phil Ewing, NPR's National Security Editor. Phil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.